Dr. Fred, I wonder if you could please explain what would be the best way to go about reading the parables and interpreting them.
Well, the parables, of course, are mostly parables of the kingdom. Now, in this instance, most of these parables related to the structure of the kingdom itself. And many of these parables are not relative to all the outside powers, except where it talks about the sower, the seed, and the good seed be the children of the kingdom, the bad seed being the children of the evil one, and so forth. And the word here is used as the word for progeny, and is definitely talking about offspring and so forth. Now, the parables are almost all of them. Unto you it is given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, to them it is not given. Christ not only spake in parables so that the enemy would not understand, but he then also gave a private interpretation to the keys of some of the most secret parables to his disciples when he drew them aside. Now, this is the reason why today that many of these parables have been only superficially approached, and in this instance they have been made to be applicable sometimes to conditions where they are unrelated. For instance, again, we have the Beatitudes and so forth, and we have instructions concerning things which Jesus taught, which also in the Gospels comes within this category. The Gospels were not written to the world. The Gospels were only written to the spiritual center of the kingdom, which was the household, the race, the people that constituted the church. And under this instance, therefore, the rules that apply here are not applicable to the world. In other words, if you have a problem with a fellow Christian and he turns to violence, sometimes you can shame him. Whereas instead of just hauling off and beating him up, well, you might turn the other cheek without resistance. Sometimes under these circumstances, with the proper words approach, why it might be some benefit of this. So Christ doesn't advocate a person being very foolish here either. See, people carry this to extremes, but what Jesus was talking about was that the Christians shouldn't be suing one another and so forth. They shouldn't be embroiled in personal problems, battles, and fights. But when it comes to the enemy, to the world order, which is diametrically opposed to you, which is designed to destroy you, he didn't say you turn the other cheek. You don't go walking up to Khrushchev and say, you drop the first bomb and we will hit you back, we'll wait for the second. See? This is not biblical. This is not has nothing to do with the program of God's kingdom. And as a function, of course, is foolish. And so when the scripture says love your enemies, the actual use of the word here these are those that might despitefully use you, but they come out of your own society, your own order, your own race. But the scripture says, don't you love my enemies. It says that if thou turns to bless my enemies or to cooperate with my enemies, then do chastisement and judgment fall on you. In other words, when it talks about the enemies of the race, or the kingdom, or the powers of darkness, the forces and principalities that surround rulers in high places, in this the kingdom is supposed to not only be resistant, but the kingdom is supposed to meet it both in the flesh as well as in the areas of mental warfare as well as spiritual power. So if you have any specific parable that you're thinking about, we'd be glad to discuss it. The most important parable of all, and the key parable, of course, must be to understand the mystery of the seed in the sower of the seed, because Christ also explains it. So the enemy pays little attention to it. It's vital and important because the seed which was sowed in the foundation of the world. The field is the world. The good seed are the children of the kingdom. And the evil seed or tares are the progeny of Lucifer, the seed of the evil one. So they both grow in the world. The angels wanted to gather all the tares out first, and the scripture said, no, let them grow together to the time of the end, lest in gathering out the tares you injure the wheat. But always the tares become identifiable at the end of the age, and just as they do in the field of wheat, they turn rusty red. So also at the end of the age, the tares have turned very identifiable, rusty red, advocating the overthrow of all the standards of God's kingdom, its patterns and laws. It's much easier to identify them today than if you hunted tares out in the past. But in the scriptures, it talks about the fact that the tares are going to be removed first, that this will be handled by the administering spirit, the angelic host, and the household of God. The tares will be removed first, so that the kingdom will come into its full. This is the symbol of the parable of the sower and the seed. Of all the parables Jesus taught, this one the disciples wanted to be sure. They made no mistake about it, and they got Jesus aside. And when they went in the upper room and they had him aside together, they said, now you explain to us so clearly the parable of the sower and the seed. And so Christ makes a clear explanation. There isn't any way for anyone to get out of it. There's two kinds of beings in the world. There's the seed of the kingdom, and then there are the seeds of Lucifer sowed into the world. This is apart from the other peoples in the world order. as it refers to these two seeds in their basic conflict. So there are many other parables that each one of them, however, carries a mysterious and symbolic meaning and was not for the world to understand. And Jesus made it quite clear that he didn't want the world to understand the full strategy of it anyhow, lest if they were to understand this, they would join the church and the kingdom and the nations and then seek to destroy it from the inside. And so therefore, he said, lest therefore they accept this and move in. He says, I'm speaking to you in parables so they will not understand. So, you know, there's a lot of people don't like to accept these factors. They think they're smarter than God sometimes. But it is a wise thing to sometimes not divulge all that needs to be said or known to those that could be the enemy, because they'll join you all right, not because they have any desire to become a part of what you were a part of, but only because they want to penetrate. There's another question. Well, the parable of the fig tree was actually more than a parable. It was actually an experience as well, because the fig tree was a symbol of jewelry. Remember that jewelry had this symbol for many, many years. It goes back to the author of the Luciferian problems in the earth. Remember that Lucifer, when he was an archangel, who in his rebellion became Satan or the devil. Remember at that one of the things that he was always identified with was with the symbol throughout all the pagan temples of the world of the fig tree. Hinduism and Buddhism weave the fig tree into all of their temple friezes and all their backgrounds. And all of the Luciferian houses and all snake cults use the fig tree as their emblem. Remember then that after the seduction of Eve, why Eve and Adam were in hiding and so forth, because they were ashamed to come into the presence of the Most High, because they had violated divine law with the seduction of Eve. And so now they had made themselves a coat of what? Of fig leaves. Not because nobody ever took fig leaves, literal fig leaves, and to make covering out of them, but it was only symbolical of the fact that they had accepted the garments of the Luciferian order, you see, Lucifer's seduction and the symbol of the fig leaf. And then, so this is why God again gives them a coat of skin, you see, in place of this. And this has got other symbolic meanings too, which is quite significant. But the fig, always the emblem of the fig leaf. You'll note that Israel is not the fig leaf. Israel is the olive tree. The Jews identify themselves as the fig leaf, and even when they, when the Canaanites sought to enter in by contaminating the line, and they thought because of the violation of law of Judah that they could lay claim to the line, but this, of course, was not possible. Even though the part of the seduction pattern of Judah in this matter, even though Judah had one son by the Canaanitish woman, never could the Canaanite offspring ever come back in and claim any royal heritage inside the line, because the race laws of our race have been so strong that from the beginning on down to our time, that there is no way that a Canaanite can get into the administration or into areas of affluence or the areas of teaching or areas of administration or inside the temple of the kingdom. And for 10 whole generations, it would require the bringing back of any such seed, and no other areas or families in the kingdom would take the jeopardy of this. And so this has been a clear-cut beginning right from the very start. And so the race question has always been important. Just as kind to getting right, kind to keep having right in itself, the differences between the Adamic race and other peoples was clearly marked when God pointed out that of all of the trees for food which existed, they could eat, but of the race tree, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, that they could not intermingle with any of the of this, and therefore they were forbidden the race tree. And the posterity of the Adamic race had to emerge forth out of Adam and Eve, that the seed line of the Most High God continues. And this was his purpose, to transfer into the earth his household, to produce a physical progeny in which the celestial begotten spirits of the household of the heavens could dwell. Because of this, the entire Old Testament is written about our race, to our race, with its instructions, with its patriarchal patterns of revelation, with the message and the revelation and the leadership and the personal intervention of God running through it from one end to the other. Other races are talked about, other kingdoms, other empires, but always it is forbidden that we intermingle or we mongrelize our seed by fusing ourselves with these people. This is significant, and it follows all the way through the Old Testament, and no change made in the New. In fact, there isn't one of all these churches that are getting out now on the limb with 1,000 of their clergy now coming out for a yes vote or no vote on Proposition 14, for instance, And they say that they Christianity has to oppose segregation and so forth. They do not have one passage in this entire Old and New Testament that supports integration. Every instruction is for the preservation and the maintenance of a race in its racial purity. And especially does this relate to our race. Is there another question?
Something about the
there was no apple involved in this. This was the seduction of Eve. This was the attempt to lie with Eve, which Lucifer sought to do, to destroy the purity of a new race, which they knew were the offspring of God. And he knew that he thought he could contaminate this and make and end the program of transferring the kingdom of God from heaven to earth by birth and by entrance and embodiment into a physical world. But he didn't count on the fact that before the foundation of the world, God had discussed this with his son, who didn't think it would happen, and then promised not only an atonement, but promised the cleansing of the bloodstream, and had told them, even in the books of Enoch, which talk about what God had declared unto us, that seven gestations would purify the bloodstream, that the gestation, and so therefore the seduction of Eve had contaminated the offspring, but the eighth gestation was set, or the seventh from Adam, see? And so this being the seventh from Adam, because the other one was not Adam, was Luciferian seed. And therefore, Adam says, behold, I have thou begotten a man after my likeness in my own image, see? And so Seth was the child of a purified womb, was the son of Adam and Eve, and the spiritual seed could function within him, and thus it bypassed the Luciferian design, whereas other sons and daughters of Adam and Eve, which spread out in an early day, were almost all of them liquidated, with the exception of Cain, who went over into the land of Nod, married the Akkads, became known as Sargon the Magnificent, which was the ancient Akkad conqueror, and you can find his and his generations down in Naram Sin, right on down through the background of the ancient Sumerians and Akkads to ancient history. We have, in fact, I have in my library volumes of ancient archaeology, and I've got copies of many of the plates in the museum in the British Museum that deal with this line, and we can establish the Cain line. But the apple is only a symbolic situation. In other words, it was forbidden them to eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. This meant that all trees with knowledge of good and evil have got to be race trees. And they have to have intellect. You can't have knowledge without an intellect. It requires an intellect. It requires, when physically embodied or formed, a brain. So therefore, to have knowledge of good and evil, it had to be peoples that had fallen under Lucifer and the Luciferian order, because no one else would have had such knowledge, because Adam and Eve were, of course, not in violation of divine law, and until they violated divine law with the contact of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Now, this is explained in the ancient books of Enoch. This is explained in the Zohar. This is clearly spread out in all of the record volumes of discussion, and I can show you many, many more of the ancient manuscripts that deal with this. And of course, it's found right here in the scripture. 31st chapter of Ezekiel talks about races and racial trees that were in the earth before Eden. So these had to be pre-existing societies before Adam. There's another question.
I heard some people use this to justify usury.
The talents in no way constitute usury. The talents in this instance was money. Money to be invested in production. In other words, the program, God's kingdom always supports that money is not to be loaned as money itself, to bring back money out of some other money. Interest in usury as such is forbidden, except when the money is in a sort of a partnership procedure and is put into areas of production. In other words, if a man has a field but he hasn't any seed, and you invest the money to buy the seed, and thus you go in with a man on production, you are entitled to whatever agreed share of the production you have agreed upon. This is not usury. This is produced wealth. You didn't take anything out of another dollar. You produced it. This is the same in any area in which you have provided the capital to increase by production. But to loan money usually against the person's misfortune, to take interest out of their labor or their income in which they have no way to
to take what you are giving them to make money with. This is forbidden because this is the way the recluse operations fold in to get widows' houses, fold in on the sick family and so forth. There are social obligations that rest upon our race as well as upon our standards and our ethics that call upon assistance to people who are in problems. And if there is the basic law that we must remember for the society that God has ordained is the law of the family. Whenever we break up the law of the family, we have broken up the first and most important economic unit within the family. In other words, therefore, when we say honor thy father and mother, it was always the responsibility of children, if their parents became old, and having raised them and having helped them and assisted them, they were no longer had the earning capacity. It wasn't a charity, it was a responsibility. It was a love operation. It was done throughout our race. Now, this again was hinged again to the responsibility to producing offspring in the kingdom of which there was to be an increase. And of course, there was all these situations that could occur where misfortune or an accident might put person in bad condition financially. But this is where the charity of the entire community of our race was responsible to assist this individual. Now, the angle was never formed within this same process that assistance was to be given to be extracted with usury to compensate what few things they might have left, which is what which is the general trend of the money racketeer. Let's face it, Satan has been in the money business ever since money was coined. And Satan's children have been exploiting this area to gain control over nations and people. And they're really parasites. They do not produce, but they always seek to gain control of all areas of production, extorting, not joining in production, but to extort and try to swindle even the areas of production, the firms themselves. There is thousands of years of the history of this kind of an operation, and I can show you volumes on it, too. The talent was not the support of usury. It was the support of the fact that when God had placed these talents in the hands of these people, this is not the significant pattern of individual gain. This was a symbol of God placing in people's hands wealth or material that they might for his kingdom. And they were to put it to work. And therefore, they didn't put it to work, maybe because they didn't feel they were going to get something individually out of it, or because they said they were frightened and they were afraid to put it to work. So they just hit it in the ground, and then it didn't do anything. In other words, the money that is just stored, that is not working, doesn't do anybody any good. Well, we hear a lot about the fact, well, it's just good to have a lot of it buried somewhere and all that. Well, we're living in a strange period of time where there might be some advantage to hard money, like silver coin or gold coin. It isn't even wiggled, but it should be. The fact still remains that this isn't either what it's talking about either, that people have acquired themselves as much as the fact is that where they move into large blocks of money and they keep, the moment that you take a lot of money out of circulation or don't keep it working, now not working as interest against interest on other dollars, but money that grows. The only kind of money that grows is when you put this money into production and you produce automobiles with the money, and now you got more than you had when you started. So you got more money back, but you created something while you did it. Plus, this men worked while this was going on. Now, at the same time, the same is true whether you're baling hay out here and you're putting more money in and you're baling more hay and you're hiring people and all this. And then if you took this money and just put it, sold it away somewhere, where it wasn't even operating at all, and God blessed and multiplied, but you just took it out of the way. What you've done is that unless you keep this working, no matter how big it gets, you don't have to put it all in the same basket, but keep it working. The moment that you have money not working, you are holding back a media of circulation for goods that are to sell, and you're clogging the economy. People don't know this, and this is one reason why. It's some of the most effective ways of economy discounted money. In fact, they discounted money as they computed the capital wealth of the nation, plus its vegetable production, its deterioration production, and the areas of what we might just call normal oxidation or deterioration wearing out. They had this done by equators who computed this. But you know, the Jews never wanted this to go. Because under this process, therefore, that if you had $1,000 and you kept $1,000 for a year and never did anything with it, you'd lose 3%. See? And because you say, well, why is this? Well, because that $3,000 would be discounted because it would be dated money. Now, the reason for this was conceived at one time because it was an evil thing to keep capital against production out of operation. Now, I don't like to get into this area of economy because it's an advanced area of economy that's understood today that there is no reason why someone says, well, an old widow, she can't get out and do anything. She better keep that money working. In other words, it better be in areas of production. So there isn't any areas of production, but there is. There's more people, there's more bona fide causes drying up for lack of the capital than you have any idea. This is the way that the enemy squeezes the small man out of business. He dries up the capital, and there isn't anything working for him. So he can't run a small farm, or he can't operate a small fishing business, or anything else. But this kind of money put in this thing becomes bigger and bigger. Someone said, well, we get overproduction, but not really, because you don't get overproduction until you get total consumption. So everybody has all they want of all the things they can consume or need. You don't have overproduction, because at the present time, we have the attitude that economy is built on scarcity, thus we raise the price to scarcity. But economy, under the laws of God's kingdom, is built on worth and value because of its utility. And therefore, it's not built on scarcity, and the more you create for it so that more people can have it, the more wealth you've made. In other words, then wealth doesn't consist of dollars itself, it consists of the things that dollars buy. The individual should be able to know that because he has worked and has accumulated what he has accumulated, which is the same as working capital, that this working capital can continue to work for him when he himself would not be working, but he joins now with the energies of his accumulation by keeping it going, not stagnating it. Okay? Now, what happens out of this principle? Well, what happens is that thus an economy is not supposed to be filled with a bunch of dip artists and going around trying to con everybody out of everything, and so you keep the Jews out. See? The Lord tells you to let them in. This will happen to the economy of any country that lets them in, and it does. Now, we were a prosperous bunch of colonies on a barter system, you know. And we had colonial money, and we got scrip at the warehouses. It worked fine. And we didn't have any problem until we got some Hyman Solomons and all these fellows in here. Pretty soon, it was a money brokerage system, see. Just brokering money on money, this is usury, see. But putting it to work is something else. Now, if a man is got a good measure, whether he's talking or what he has. In other words, if therefore capital puts expands and gets more truck running, it brings in more business, it's moving more goods, it's hiring more people, it's still keeping things rolling. Now, you say, well, the pyramid's at the top. It doesn't pyramid to the top until population increases any. At the present time, we're watching increased population with reduced production. What they're attempting to do now, instead, labor today says, well, what we've got to do, therefore, is to get more money for less time. No, what we've got to do is produce more goods. So this is why, because more goods produced will increase earnings and purchasing power to buy goods produced. And more goods produced will fill the goods needs here and eventually throughout the world, but fill this one first. See? Now, eventually, it will be possible for man to produce everything he needs all over the world in 3 days a week, maybe 2.5 days a week. Maybe we'll get smart enough where we can push buttons, see? But this is all right, but you've got to learn the relationship of the equity in the production as it relates to the individual. In other words, we need economies of plenty, not of scarcity. This isn't made by just spending phony money. It's not backed by production. This is backing things by production, but there's plenty for everybody, and everybody produces, or in some way, because you take the family, the mother who produces the family, who looks after the affairs of the family, it still had her area of production. The teacher may not be producing any commodity, but they're producing services. And so you learn the equity, both goods and services. And you thus evaluate goods and services. And this requires equity and equity. We do far better with equity and equity than we would with international bankers in World War II funds. And this, not only, now you see what happens, well, it ends up that people who have homes and they have the things they want in it, and they have purchasing power, and that's real wealth, not some imaginary money that they can evaluate next week, or take away from you even the right to have the coin. So if that goes through with any good, well, somebody thinks it is. And if you can't do anything else with it, I'd haul all the silver to the Eastern Kodak Company and they'll buy it, you know.
Another question?
Is there anything wrong with the pig?
Anything wrong with the pig?
Yeah.
Well, it's not if it's right. The complaint? Don't compare the fig as an eatable piece of fruit with the fig tree race. You see, these Jews had so long identified themselves with the fig tree race that when Herod, who was a Kike and not an Israelite and not of Judah and Benjamin, came to the Isle of Pergamum. And you turn over here in the second chapter of the book of Revelation, and Jesus said that Pergamus is where Satan's seat is. He says to the church there in Pergamus, "My, I know your problem." And he says, "You're living in the very spot where Satan has his headquarters." See? Well, you can't get any plainer than that. Well, they, after the fall of Babylon, they had moved their gold headquarters here and made a virtual citadel out of it in the sea there, see? And it was existent there all during the periods of Medo-Persia and during the periods of Greece and Rome, and was still existent in the time of Christ's ministry. And they used this gold and its purchasing power, manipulation power, to control empires. And they bought for Herod the kingship over the territory under Rome. Though Rome gave autonomy to the people locally, it was still under the kingship of Herod, king of who? The Jews, over Judea. Now, the peoples of Judah and Benjamin were not Jews, but Herod was a Jew and ruled over them. So when we understand the relationship of this, when he built a temple, and covered it with gold, so it'd be known as Herod's temple, and all around the rim of this were the fig leaves and the serpent. And all interwoven in it is a six-pointed star overwrapped and interwoven, made out of serpent heads. You go down on Beverly Boulevard, and when you get down there, not far from the farmer's market in that area, and you get right down in there, across from the Pan Pacific Auditorium, just down from the Pan Pacific, there is a synagogue there. And you go look at that synagogue the next time you go by. Its six-pointed stars are woven in an overlapping weave out of serpents, with the end of it being the serpent holding his tail in his mouth. See? Now, and all around this building are the fig leaves and the serpents, see? And just as Moses said, they're the children of the serpent. And Jesus said, ye generation of the serpent, he said to those Jews, who warned you to flee from the judgments to come? So you see that in this, now the fig is a fruit, wasn't anything wrong with that, but because the Jews had always identified their ecclesiastical rule with the fig leaf, and always their secret political rule with the mystery of the serpent. The serpent and Lucifer was referred to as Lucifer, the great dragon, and the mighty serpent. In the 12th chapter of Revelation, it says Lucifer, the fallen archangel, was always the dragon. He's known as Satan, the devil. He's also known as the serpent in the sky. Now, I can show you the Star Bible, in which constellations, which were formed millions of years ago, still had the significant cycle of the events that would affect the Earth as it relates to our position in this factor. And Hydra, the serpent, was Luciferian's title in rebellion. Now, you'll note that wise as the serpent, cunning with wisdom, but falling, he becomes the serpent and the dragon. So they identify themselves with this. So when Jesus came along, and there was the fig tree, and Jesus wanted to point this out now to his disciples, because everybody knew that these were the figs up here, anybody that was connected with the temple was the ecclesiastical order of these Luciferians, but they had palmed themselves off as the ecclesiastical rulers, and they were Canaanites. There was Annas and Caiaphas and Canaan, all of the Canaanite house. And they had the serpents on the temple now. Herod's temple. And Jesus came along. He says, now go check that fig tree over there and bring me some fruit. So the disciples knew there must be some reason he did this. And he went over there and there wasn't anything on it. It was just all dried up with little hard things you couldn't eat. And they came back and they said, well, Master, there isn't any fruit on the fig tree. All right, he says, because it doesn't have any eatable fruit, cursed is it forever. Never shall it bring forth any fruit that's eatable forever. And immediately, and the disciples looked at one another, because the fig tree was the symbol of the temple, and they knew he knew what was on the tree, and they knew that he didn't expect to get anything off the tree, that he'd only taught them this for a lesson. That afternoon, they came back by the fig tree, and all the leaves had turned brown, and the whole thing was withering. And this spread abroad what had happened, and the priests in the temple knew that he had wrought this miracle against them. And they plotted together how they might put him to death. So now, so some people thought after that was a mistake. There's nothing wrong with figs. It was just that this was, Jesus asked for figs, and when there wasn't any on the fig tree, it was just because there wasn't any fruit in Jewry, and he wanted to explain what it was.
Yeah.
Dr. Quirk, do you know anything on that star that supposed to be an evil star, or the star, or something like that, in the latter days? Well, stars of themselves are not the evil. When Lucifer rebelled, he affected 1/3 of the astronomical bodies, which were under his direct administration. Now, this is a symbol. The universe is a circular universe, a noble universe. And its farthest perimeter returns back again to in its orbit, God holding this universe together. This is the expansion, compression universe. And of course, this, I don't want to get into this area of life physics and so forth, but I just want to cite this, that there's no beginning, no ending, the five eternal. This principle may have overlapping layer upon layer, as far as depth is, in or out. The known center of the universe fluctuates almost like an elliptic out of balance, but it moves out from the Pleiades. It's the exact known center on which even the Milky Way, and everything in it, is gravitating around this over an antiquity of aeons. Now, so with this picture of rotating universe, and with the cycle of divine purpose, Lucifer and all of his hosts rebelled, but the Father knew this before it happened and permitted the archangel to do this, because in this he was going to try to take over the throne, refusing to recognize the offspring of the divine family. So at a given point where God announced the family of which you and I are a part, and where your spirit existed with you before the world was framed, that is just creation. Lucifer refused to participate in this because he didn't want to acknowledge anything higher than he was. When he asked the question, will they be greater than I? And the Father said, they shall be even as I. Now, Enoch is told this again so that he would record it for us to remember. And so in this again, when he rebelled, he took 1/3 of the stars of the heaven. Now this meant that 1/3 of all of the solar systems in the universe were under Luciferian administration and were brought into rebellion. And so they were inhabited by beings in physical planes, as well as angelic hosts and lesser angelic orders and so forth. So in this rebellion, they fought against the Most High. And they're just like they're on a leash. They can only go out so far. Finally, they'll be brought back and down on their knees. Right now, they create the friction of it. We're in the struggle of it. The sons of God have even transacted that plan to the very spot where Lucifer defeated by the great faith horns of Michael. Here on the earth and in the solar system where they were condensed is the very place where God said, here's where I'll incubate my sons and daughters. Here, I will put them in the very earth, and these my sons and daughters are going to overthrow this, and I'll join them, and the family is going to be triumphant that Lucifer refused to recognize. But out of it comes a new set of values. In other words, if everything in its righteousness and its order is held together by the principles of law, all that is constructed by within it and held together by it never will appreciate the organization of the power of its law, or the values that are involved, or the love with which God holds that which is his own plus that which is his creation, until they have watched the total investment of God himself into that which he has produced to bring it back in order. Thus it is that you have the miracle of atonement or the atonement. You have the processes of now knowing the difference between right and wrong by comparison. And all the patterns of total experience, when eventually will be added up in relationship with grace, God said will have been worthwhile. And even evil will have been made to praise him, and it will eventually be expunged from the universe And in that day, even Lucifer is going to worship at your feet. So some people have a kind of a narrow-minded little theology, and they've got a kind of a twisted-up God. And in this instance, where they got a God who has to sit back and torture people to satisfy himself because of their rebellion. When they don't perceive that in his omniscience, there wasn't anything that he didn't know, and anything that even in the plans of the areas of energy and violation going off on its own orbit, he knew exactly how far it could go and how much restraint he would put in for the protection of his own household, while they also were nurtured and matured in the extremes of administration, because he knew what he'd been given to sit with him to see his authority throughout the vastness of his universe. Remember, the increase of his own household in this earth will be as the sand of the seashore, the stars of the heaven. There's 126 billion times 10 suns with solar systems alone out there. Now, that are visible with an electronic telescope that can be photographed. Now, how much limited and layer there is beyond that? Now, if you just had one offspring of the Most High God, well, each one of those solar systems with a sun, that stretches it off and thin pretty lonely. So you can see that of the increase of his kingdom there shall be no end. But that, again, we who have passed this route have developed an area of experience that sometimes we evaluate only the casualties we see, never realizing that there isn't any casualty that gets out of the perimeter of God's grace or the magnitude of his love or the light of his being. That he's able, with the unction of the aura of his own being, to eventually purge out the error in anything. This era of such white light fire is called Shekinah glory. In some instances, it's translated because of the superstitions of some mythology that the Greeks had picked up, because when they translated words into their semantics, they used the words related to their mythology and they wove it into our mythology today. The Apostle Paul, for instance, was talking about the prison chamber of the fallen angels, or rather Jude talks about this. And of course, as we mentioned this Sunday, the prison chamber of the fallen angels is the word Tardius. Well, Tardius is a word in Greek mythology for a perdition beneath a perdition, or a prison chamber that for the Titans, and the Titans were the beings who were giants and monster beings who had come out of the intermingling or the intercourse of the gods with men. Now, if you go back to what you call Greek mythology today, you'll discover that these gods, and especially some of these strange ones, intermingled with men, and their offsprings were called Titans, and this strange intermixture of these gods and men. But these are not the gods positive. They're a part of the Luciferian host in rebellion, as against the sign of Zeus, and of course Jupiter, as they marked it. And the only reason why they named it the name of the most of the largest or one of the most brilliant planets with its seven suns, the reason why they marked this is because this in to the ancients was only a symbol of the movement of power through the heavens. And we don't want to get into this now, but the thing is that this Greek mythology was not actually a myth. It was built on early foundations of tradition, and I can take you into the Old Testament. And I can take Preacher and tie him up in 20 knots if he doesn't know what this is all about. I'll show you here where these gods did intermingle with men, and they did produce giants and monsters, even after your race came here, and that's why we had a flood to drown those rascals out. It took place where they lived, not all over the world. There wasn't any flood in Egypt. There wasn't any flood in South America at the time of the flood, you know. So you see, this was a judgment that God poured out at that spot to save the total destruction of his posterity that were dwelling in that place. Now, the reason I point this out is because Lucifer was star of the morning. This means he was the sun of his corner of the universe. Not just a sun for one solar system, but he was the guiding illuminator. In other words, he was light, knowledge, destruction. He administered under God over one great portion of the universe, one-third of the time of his fall. Now, therefore, he turns to the darkness and no longer can put out light, destruction, healing, creating. He can only destroy, mutate, and disintegrate. Now, therefore, when we talk about the dark star, there are astronomical bodies which are rather strange. There are a few of them that may be a part of things that relate to violent rock. There is in space, hurtling through space now, an opaque object that reflects no light. This is hard for anyone here to perceive, even in the extent of modern physics, because we think of all
substances having some ability to reflect. There are substances that absorb all known light within the spectrum. There is a body of objects so big and traveling through space that it does not reflect any light. The only reason why we know it's there is because as it travels on the photograph and the map, which are made every few seconds apart through great scopes such as we have down here at Palomar and so forth, it blocks out the light of other stars as it goes by. So the only reason why we know it's there is because it cuts the path across the sky map. Okay? So now, there is significance concerning ancient prophecies, not found in the scriptures, essentially, but tied in, that is, into these 66 books. I don't say that this is all scripture by any means. Not found in what we have correlated here in the scripture, there's no mention of this particular dark star. There is the star Wormwood that falls into the sea. This is a cyanide of potassium meteor of great size, almost like a burning with fire, which causes a catastrophe where it falls, and this is yet to come, but in a given spot. But the point is, this is why it's referred to as Bitteraumen, the Wormwood state, because it's a cyanide condition in it. It has something else. Now, getting on with this, therefore, Lucifer is the symbol of the black star, but the star is a reality in significance and in measure. Maybe only permitted that we might be able to measure certain events by it if we start enough. But there is such a star. It's another thing that were phenomena. They hurtled through the sky about 7 years ago, 8 years ago. A great boulder looked like the Rock of Gibraltar. It came from the northeast and traveled to the southwest. In one of those periods, I was in the back of a pickup truck high up on the Piute Mountains. And there was a couple of men in the truck and a couple of us standing up in the back. It was during deer season, and the sky was overcast with regular. And I happened to look up, and here this thing was cutting a swath through the clouds, just like it was evaporating them, just like it was cutting a cut right through the clouds, so you could see the blue vault above it, just absorbing this cloud as it went. But this was so huge, it was like a huge rock mountain turning and twisting and never falling, not illuminated, and with no light, it just this great boulder. And I banged on the hood of the cab, and they stopped, and they saw it, and four of us watched it. But you know, you can't tell anybody about that, because you tell somebody you saw a great mountain like the Rock of Gibraltar hurtling through sky, cutting the swath through clouds, but it passed over Edwards. And it passed on over San Bernardino, and it went clear down over Texas, and it was last seen out over the Caribbean Sea, see. So I've got two or three things in which they said they didn't know what this was. It looked like a huge boulder that was cutting across the heavens. Of course, the clouds that were up there were not over San Bernardino. It was blue sky over San Bernardino, but it was a great boulder traveled over it. And over Texas, it was a great boulder, and over the Caribbean, they said it was like a huge meteor that never came down. Only it was a huge rock-like boulder that went sailing through the sky. Well, no telling how big this thing was, see? But it is true that it had to be within the atmospheric levels of Earth, cutting its corner across, but it never came down like a meteor. It just kept on going, see? And it must have followed to some extent, though maybe not to the true periphery, the Earth's circumference, or it would have shot off in space before it got far enough over, well, you could have seen it to the Caribbean, maybe. It's possible. But anyhow, they didn't see it, so this is just one of those things. So I kept record of that, because I got record of lots of things, strange or not. But the thing about this is that this was also referred to as like the opaque object on a larger scale that was cutting off the light of the stars. We've got one that circles the Earth at the equator. It's a mechanical satellite of great size that has been going around the Earth at the equator for the last 7,500 years, anyhow. That's another subject. Question? What did you say? Well, the Star Bible is a Bible of constellations and of the decans and houses of the sun and the moon, which was known in the days of Noah and known in the days of Enoch, and when our patriarchal forefathers had been taught the mysteries of the measure, why they set up this. The Temple of Zendetta, for instance, in ancient Egypt, had 612 major luminaries from first to seventh magnitude, and had the entire procession of the equinoxes rest, of course, at that time the constellation, or rest that time of Venus, because Venus hadn't come in yet. Venus was the comet which had given us lots of trouble over several ancient periods of history, and had a lot to do with upheavals that even affected the rise and fall of mountain ranges and the sinking of continents. But Venus never came into our solar system to become permanent and take its orbit until around 1480 B.C., on up to a period around 1440 or 1436 B.C. And it was during that period of time that the catastrophes hit Egypt, the plagues that fell upon them at the time of the Exodus. And also remember, the scripture says it was either light or dark for 40 years, because the world, the atmosphere was filled with debris from what had happened as we passed through the comet's tail, and the comet had become a planet and scattered its debris across the universe. And the dust and the debris kept the light of the sun from coming through, except as it filtered it as though it were through a smoky cloud. And this happened. You know, we had that happen to another kind of phenomenon on the Earth. When Mount Pelee blew up in Krakatoa, it threw so much dust and dirt into the sky with that greatest of all explosions that we can remember. The greatest noise that man can remember hearing is when Krakatoa blew up. They heard it in London, from all the way over in the islands. They heard it all around the world, see? And the dust was many years before it was all out of the atmosphere. And it made the sun go down like going down through smoke for years and years. I can show you all the records on that, because it bothered astronomers. They couldn't yet get any real clear viewing through those years or anything else. Of course, we've had a little relationship to this in some of our nuclear experiments, but of all the nuclear bombs put together, they never began to approach the strength and explosive power of Krakatoa. Another question?
What is the difference between the fifth point and the ninth point?
That's one more point. The five-pointed star has been used for many centuries. The six-pointed star, there wasn't anything wrong with the six-pointed star at all. The six-pointed star had a basic symbol in our race ages ago. It was a symbol of two pyramids, one pointed up and one pointed down, overlapping. It was a symbol of the spiritual and the physical emblems of the kingdom. One building upward towards God, and the other building downward towards man, for the unity of heaven and earth to build the kingdom. The six-pointed star was the symbol of the kingdom. This is why it's called the Davidic star. For the star of David was the kingdom of God on earth, for David was God's king, ruling on God's throne till God took that throne in the earth. Now when the Jews formed the six-pointed star they were trying to steal the star of David. But in stealing this star, they interwove it, not as one pyramid overlapping another, but an interlaced set of triangles, and wove it out of a serpent. So the actual, whereas now we see six-pointed stars all around, you know, lots of sheriffs have six-pointed stars. You know where it came from? When the moneylenders, who were the Jews in Europe, wanted to foreclose on people's property, they had to have an officer to collect, and so they hired a bandit. They collected for him, and they called him a sheriff, see? And he wore a Jew six-pointed star. That's how it started. Then when they gained control of England through the Bank of England, why, they controlled this, and they established their sheriff. Well, even before they had the banks, the moneylenders had their sheriffs answerable to them, but they, under the Bank of England, they had their sheriffs, and these sheriffs were actually a governmental authority deposed for the collection of funds due to the bankers and the holders, see? And thus it was, all they did is go around, serve papers, foreclose down properties. Now today they're just general law enforcement officers, except you go back into New York and the sheriff is just a bailiff to go around and serve papers on you, because they have state police and local police. So here the sheriff is a different situation. But you see, that's what it was at that time. So that's why, and that's how the six-pointed star got on there too, see? We always were suspect when they set that star on that sixth army, see. We were watching Reminiscer and we're made pretty close there, but there's a story about that too, but that's another title. But the six-pointed star has as much right in our heritage, because it's the sign of the kingdom of God in heaven and earth, built on earth and thus established, spiritual and physical, in the earth. The five-pointed star was used after the six-pointed star became identified with the Jews. Then in revolt against the Jews, all of the Aryan economy
became tied to five-point stars. However, we'll get that six-point star back, and they can take the snake with them. Another question yet? You're using Adam Rutherford's figures.
Yes.
Well, the figures are all right, but the interpretation isn't. Let me point this out. This building was built by our forebears. This was built in the days of Enoch and Job, not out at the later period that they ascribed to it. The pyramid was there before the flood. The pyramid has a part in Egyptian history before this. The pyramid was built by the people that built the city of On, by Enoch and Job. They built the pyramid. They were the two pillars of wisdom who erected the two pillars of wisdom and symbol at the temple squares. They divided the city into 12 segments, and there were 12,000 savants for each month of the year who were artisans and craftsmen that worked on the building of the pyramid. They built the temples of On, which were the temples of divine weights and measures. And so they built the temple of On. The temple of On was of the temple of light and of knowledge. And this is where Asenath, daughter of Potiphar, who was the head priest of the temple of On, that Joseph married when he was down in Egypt. And this was a white woman. And that's why Jacob said, "Let my name Israel be named on these two heads, Ephraim and Manasseh." There was no violation of race law here. They were the same household. Now, this calling won a queen's chamber, won a king's chamber, came because later this was built under the leadership of our savants who built this in the days of Enoch and Job. This was built as a great temple and a spiritual measuring instrument of the heavens to not only measure processions of equinoxes related to the factors of earth, but to also measure the progression of measures that related to prophetic time measures on the earth. They also contained, in an inch to the year, and an inch to the month scales, and so forth, given measures that would start at a given point in history to take on their significance forwards and backwards. No way did it relate to the time of the building of the pyramid. It only related to the time when these measures would start, which reached to 2144 and 2141 B.C., only a casement stone factor away or there. This is why we find some difference between the measures. There's no difference in the actual number. One man measuring so many inches isn't going to come out any different than anybody else measuring so many inches. But there are a lot of fellows with pet theories. They wanted to make the pyramid prove these theories. So if they didn't have enough inches, well, they measured out into the solid rock somehow. And if they didn't have any reason for that, well, they would take a compass, for instance, and they would take a radii to be the exact distance they wanted to go out with solid rock and draw a circle. Then they'd give some reason why they had a circle there and why they was out in the radii to come up with a figure they wanted. Now, this is what I want to say about pyramid and pyramid measurement. When you have to take the pyramid like you take something that God has already said. You have to take it as something that's fixed. And so when you measure it, you've got to measure it like it is, never caring whether it's acceptable with some theory you have or somebody else has at all. It's not important. Remember that there was a sarcophagus in the king's chamber, and that was put there. And it wasn't put there by any Egyptian king, and it wasn't put there for any Egyptian king. For the outline of this pyramid had been given to Enoch and Job at the time they were building this pyramid, and it was to conform to prophecies that were even more ancient than this. And that sarcophagus was to hold, after the flood, the body of Adam until the resurrection. And they didn't need to seal the top because this was in a room already sealed whose air chambers were sealed. And it wasn't to be entered into after a certain line of fulfillment until the end of the age. And I could tell you lots of mysteries that surround this that are known in the ancient lore of our race. And that knowing about this that a lot of pyramidologists just working along with this hunk of stone and a ruler don't know anything about. And they have had their eyes so close to this mathematical precise monument that they didn't go into the source of light. And whereas there's passages in the pyramid, there's far more passages in my Bible. So I tell you this, that within this situation, these are significant. This king's chamber, as they call it, was the chamber of the resurrection. And it carries its measure also into what the resurrection symbol, the new age and the new order. And the other, and so its measures are measures which do affect historical dates and values and alignments that were in the sky were even more significant with these intersections than just what men may have interpreted in by measurement. Now, the queen's chamber was not established for a queen. In other words, the only reason why they got this, the one had a tomb in it, the other didn't have any tomb in it. And when they got in there, they didn't find any body. There wasn't any king's body in that tomb. Wouldn't it be funny that a pharaoh would build a pyramid and then have his not have his body in it? Oh, well, they said the Pharaoh fell mammon broke in at 800 B.C. and stole all the loot out. Well, he got in there, there wasn't any loot, and he was unhappy. This is why he was so angry, because he got in there and didn't get anything. He went in there and thought there'd be treasures in there. There wasn't any treasures in there. And there wasn't even any body in there. And this is a matter of history. You can go back and read what Pharaoh fell mammon found there. Why? You may have read in the pyramid how there was a great passageway torn between the vault that goes down to the descending passage and to the ascending passageway, and it comes out at the intersection of the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, do you know why that was? Because that great force that tore out was a symbol of the tearing out from the nether world of the chamber of death. In other words, when Adam died, his spirit was held in the nether world until Christ's resurrection. And when Christ came up out of the grave, he brought forth the spirits of every last one of the sons and daughters of the Adamic race, and there isn't one single one of the Adamic race. Every one of his captivity sons brought forth captive and took his many sons on high into glory, became the captain of their salvation. Now, and the body of Adam was not left in the earth, but was also brought out at that time. And this great hole torn through is the symbol out of the pit of the tearing of the hole through to the resurrection ascending passage. And it comes right at the date of Christ's resurrection. And that's what this signifies. And Adam went out of there at the same time that Christ ascended. And remember that if you turn to the book of Matthew, that the dead walked the streets of Jerusalem at that time as well. Many people overlooked that passage in Matthew. And this is what had these Jews all hiding down in the treasury of the temple, scared to death to come out. The dead were walking the streets. Well, that would take anybody, you know. And they started out the moment that Christ went in. Now, therefore, the symbolism of other pyramids were built round about. These pyramids were later built by Egyptians as monuments to their dynasty. But this first one wasn't built as a monument to the dynasty. This was built as a blueprint, not only the plan of God, but of a temple of measure, but of a covenant that God made with Atlanteans when they worshipped him as Yahweh Phutah, and when the catastrophe of Lucifer's violation of law started mongrelization and integration, and the catastrophes of it caused the judgments to fall, and God sealed the pyramid temples of Atlantis, took out his celestial children who were ministering in spiritual bodies, and he told the Atlantean priests of those that didn't go with Lucifer, Horus, that the day would come when he would send again his sons in earth, and they would dwell in bodies, and that they would build again a temple unto him in the earth, like unto the temple that they had in the land he was now going to destroy, and that they would build again this when they were in bodies, even as they had bodies. Prior to this time, we had served as celestial bodies, and we were withdrawn, not maybe us, but of the household of God, we were withdrawn the moment this contamination, violation of divine law, mongrelization, mutations had quenched. Now, the rulers, or kings, in Atlantis were Khufu. This is the title. This was their name, Khufu. This doesn't mean this is their personal name. And so Khufu was the title. They didn't call him Pharaoh then. They called him Khufu. Now, so those that wouldn't mongrelize with these Negroes, go to all the bestiality, like happens to the pagan temples in Asia today and so forth. All this catastrophe was happening on the island on Atlantis. And so God started to crack it with earthquakes, and the water rushed into the fires and the volcanoes, and the fire blew the tops off with steam, and it shattered them, and the whole, we've got a whole description of how it happened, what the horizon, and geology proves this happened. What happened out here, for instance, where the Azores are. Those Azores, those mountains and that land under the sea, where the Azores stick up, was once all above the sea because there are volcanic scarps laying there that are 20 and 30 miles long. Now, anybody that knows anything about flowing lava knows it doesn't run at all. It just piles up. That it couldn't run under the sea, and that that land had to all be on, up above the ocean for those scarps to run out there for those miles. And not one, but all over that continent when the eruption of the earthquake took place. So therefore, the only time that you can get a volcano under the sea, if it goes underwater, it just piles up. When it gets to piling up, you end with it Hawaiian Islands. Hawaiian Islands today are from volcanoes that just piled up. But it doesn't run, and it has to get above the surface before it can run. So this is geology, and it's a matter of science. Now, when we deal with this, therefore, these people migrated before the land bridges were broken off connecting Atlantis with North Africa. A lot of them had already turned to these wild orgies. You know, they're still at it again. They've got peopleopoly. You may have heard about that today. All the wild orgies and mongrelization is going on now just like a great temple of love. Right now, in San Francisco, all over, there's clippings on it. It's a new thing they're working out. It's sordid. It's evil to the extreme. They're trying to push it in colleges in Oregon and all over. It's rotten and totally sordid. Now, but you see, a lot of these people of ancient Atlantis had worshipped the true religion, the true God, and they didn't buy all these Luciferian. They couldn't help the fact that they were influenced after the archangel that ruled this world had now come down and declared himself as God and started up all this, and all these people were moved forth, but they were people that went out from this, and they were the survivors. Now there were some others that survived too, because they fled quick early, such as Tito, king of the nations, in the scriptures he talked about, and Tito means king of the land beneath the waters. And I'll show you this in Genesis. Well, so in the books of Horus, which are the oldest writings of Egypt, they talk how they migrated across North Africa, how they settled over there around this great river, the Nile, and in its basin. And it was far more luxurious at that time. It wasn't just a desert sandy spot. It was all a different situation. That's about 11,000 years ago. Now, the fact remains that they waited and anticipated the day would come. And so they had set up their worship, and they worshiped the god of light, Ra, and they worshiped just as Ra-Mu had been the symbol of the god of light even in Lemuria, and in Atlantis also, and they waited for the revelation of his son, Yahweh-Puta, and their kings were called Khufu. This is the pre-ancient dynasties of Egypt. Now you come in the later dynasties, first, second, and third dynasties of later Egypt. And it was during these later dynasties of Egypt that Enoch and Job went down into the land of Egypt, and the moment they came, the Egyptians said that here is the children of Yahweh Putah, and so they the Ka of Ra, or the soul of the God of Light. Now, later when our people built this great altar and pyramid, it was just, they accepted this because it was just like the pyramid temple they used to worship in. The only the passageways were different and everything, but they worshiped the pyramid temple. They immediately thought, they knew that this was a symbol of restored life and resurrection. There had been no death prior to this. Now, what did they refer to? They said that we are the children of Osiris, the Ka of Ra, or the children of the Lord of life and resurrection, the white man is. This is what they said, children. And they then, the better Egyptian that wasn't taken over by Seti and Thoth and the dark occult gods, worshipped Osiris, Lord of life and resurrection, which was a title which they gave to an eventual embodiment of God who was going to come out of his own race, who was going to accomplish a mighty miracle, conquer death, and come back from the river Styx and save the world. Now, so therefore, that prophecy was a prophecy of the coming of Christ, who would come out of the race which he had given birth to as Yahweh in the earth, and come out of this race, and die in a body, and cross the river Styx, which was the death realm, into the netherworld, come back up out of it and bring all the people up and set them free. And so his name, Osiris, Lord of Life and the Resurrection. Now, the temple, the pyramid, was the temple of the Lord of Life, the Resurrection, in which every individual is like a living stone, the whole thing sealed together by the emblem of that in which all the images complete the capstone. And therefore, the pyramid was the temple of Ra. It was the temple of Yahweh Putah, And this they understood. Now, later pharaohs came along, and they built for themselves great funeral temples. And in the days of one of the emperors, you see, and many of these pharaohs called themselves, they continued to use. The word was Khufu or Pharaoh. It was being used, see. And there was one of these, of course, this is Amenhotep, and he was the pharaoh that when the Greeks came into Egypt, he was on the throne, and they called him Cheops. And therefore, Cheops had built alongside of the bottom of the pyramid a funeral temple by the big pyramid of Giza that had been there all these years. He says, I want to be buried here, and he built his funeral temple alongside of it. Now, on the pyramid itself is the cartouche word Khufu is there. Now, this is on the layer stone. It was, but it doesn't give a number or a name. This is the name of all rulers of Egypt. And when Enoch and Joel built this temple was built, but later a emperor or any pharaoh could have cartouched it. But they came along and he built a funeral temple and Cheops did this thing. So along comes a lot of terminology and says, it doesn't make a difference who built it. It makes all the difference in the world who built it. It says it don't make a difference whether it was built for a tomb or not. Well, it does make a lot of difference what it was built for. It was built for an altar, for a temple, and for a measure, and for a place where when the flood came in the upper Tavian Basin, the body of Adam had been carefully and skillfully preserved and had been embalmed and preserved. Our race, you know, taught the Egyptians embalming. It was embalmed till the resurrection to keep it. And they kept this mummified body of Adam in the cave of the treasury. And here the writings of Adam and Eve, and the books of Seth, and the books of the bee, which were scrolls on papyrus, they kept these things, and they were traditionally copied and kept, and this is in the upper Tavian Basin where Noah was living when he was told to build the ark. And when he built the ark, one of the things he took with him, they went and brought the body of Adam on the ark, plus these scrolls with him. And after the flood, they were told that Shem took the responsibility, the others didn't, of taking the body of Adam from that spot down into the land of Egypt where they would find others of their brethren, where a sarcophagus had been placed in the temple of Yah to hold the body of Adam till the resurrection. And that's why it's an ancient Persian tradition, and that's why the Shemites made their trip on down after the flood. That's why these Shemites went all the way down to Egypt, and that's why they joined again at the temple of all their brethren. That's why they had the great ceremony of the second temple of the second ceremony of dedication, and they had the high communion, which was the first time that was between the two pillars in ancient Egypt. And Enoch tells about this, and that's when they finally locked in and sealed the pyramid. They closed it then because the body of Adam was in its place, and they let the plug slide down and locked the passage over the descending passageway, and they sealed it on the outside. And the only way to get into that was from the Sphinx, but this is another story. And so it's been sealed up. Now, actually, this stayed that way, and there was never was it open. And when Caleb El Mammon crashed into it in the year 800 to get out the treasures, thinking that that the funeral temple on the outside of Khufu, who they called Cheops, they was out there. This had nothing to do with that pyramid at all. This just fellow just come along and built his little house alongside it. They buried him in it, but that thing was there ages before this. Was there before the flood, so you can compute it. It couldn't have been built after the flood. Say. Now, Davidson was quite a brilliant engineer. Did a lot of research on the figures and facts and the mathematics involved in the pyramid. And he knew from also the records and traditions that extended from Babylonia all the way over to even ancient China concerning this great mighty stone mountain. And because of the antiquity of records which we have concerning the pyramid in 1st, 2nd dynasties, he knew that this was before the flood. This was built before the flood. Well, Adam Rutherford is my good friend. There's no inaccuracy in his measures, but in his interpretation there is. And he goes and talks with some of these archaeologists over here in Egypt at the Egyptian Museum, and comes back and they agree with him, or he agrees with them, and this is and they agree with anybody while you're there too. But the fact is that I believe in his sincerity. But and as far as his book is concerned, he's got one of the finest books ever written on chronology. This in this he's most accurate. And in many of the things concerning it, he believes that he has the right interpretation as to the symbolisms until they got to the chamber of the new birth and all these patterns. Now, as far as the symbolism, which is the pyramid's concern, it shows two things. It symbolizes two things, many more things too, but it symbolizes the spiritual kingdom and it symbolizes the literal kingdom on earth. And one of them, it runs a straight continuity out to the millennium, and the other one, it runs through all the course of events the political kingdom runs through. But, and so until you get to this end time measure, and then you've got to know the sky measure to go on with it. Now, we will take time sometime with a projected chart and with a computer chart to show the relationship of this. Probably we'll do that in the auditorium in Los Angeles too, because we want people interested in it. We don't care with either whether it agrees with just books on terminology. We are vitally interested in what it has to do with the ancient lore of our race, with things known by men and passed on to sons. You know, men don't talk about what's in a pyramid 2,000 years before it was built. And when you pick up material from ancient Egypt, when you pick up a scroll that comes from Karnak, in its lower tomb levels, when you pick up something down here in South America that the Mayas have, that talks about also that was deposited there by Manasseites, and when you discover here that here is a record of ancient hearts, and they're talking about this pyramid, then they come along and talk about how the white race built this pyramid, and they end up with things which establishes the scriptures also this who built it. Well, you can't come along and stick it after the flood and say, well, then we can give it who built it. You know as well as I do that no ignorant Egyptian that didn't have any spiritual knowledge of God's mystery could have put that thing together. They not only wouldn't know how to put it together, they wouldn't know what measures to put in there, they wouldn't have had the knowledge, they wouldn't have had the light. But those fellows weren't working by guess. They had the finest blueprint in the world. They operated under an area of cognition and with a science that was beyond anything. Why, Moses was a pretty smart chap. Now let's face it, Moses was one of the smartest boys of our race. And Moses was raised by Pharaoh's daughter. And he was raised as the son of Pharaoh's daughter, but he was a white man and an Aryan. And when he was educated, he selected to be, first he was educated by who? His own mother was selected to raise him, and she raised him in the history tradition of his race. What happened when he got older? Well, he went down to On, right down there, to be educated further by the pyramid builder race, the temple builders of wisdom. And he learned the wisdom and the knowledge. He knew these things. And I can show it to you, stretched through his writings in here, too. Now, note that Moses was famous for lots of things. You know, he built the great treasure city of Memphis and the great treasure chambers of Pharaoh. Why, he was the only one smart enough to do this. He was the engineer, prince son, so-called, of Pharaoh. And he built those treasure cities. He had the Egyptians working by the thousands to work at them. But even though they built pyramids and funeral temples, they didn't use the science that lifted 800-ton blocks of stone and other things that were done. They didn't know how to apply the light measure. And the light measure was not shown to Moses because he was not to become a worker in stone, but he was to become a builder with men. So he was architect, designer, craftsman. He could direct this, but they didn't give to him the secret of the levitation. So this is something else. There's a story on that. So you see, all these things fly in. But here we go back to this pre-period and find that when Moses built the treasure cities, that the pyramid was already built many years before, and that when in the days when the Tower of Babel was being constructed at Ur of the Chaldees, the ode to the tower said that their tower will reach to the sky. It'll be higher than the pinnacle in Egypt erected to Yah. Now, what was the pinnacle in Egypt? It was the chief cornerstone in the land of Egypt. It was the pyramid. Already it was known as the pinnacle in Egypt. And so their tower was going to be higher than this. They were going to the sky. And when was that? That was shortly after the flood in Ur of the Chaldees. This was before Ur was called Ur of the Chaldees, when they had the Tower of Babel shaken by the great earthquake, and everybody got scared and talked in his own language and had to run home instead of lose their head. And people hear that's when languages were changed. There's nothing to that. That's just the way somebody balled the story up. But the fact remains that the emperor who built this had made a law that everybody, and he had people from all over the world helping to build this big tower, and they said that everybody had to speak in his own language, because whenever an empire uses slave labor and people from other lands, if they can talk in their own language, they can plot. But if they all have to speak in one language, they can't get together and plot. So always shaking hangs the crown upon an empire like this. And so everybody had to talk in one language so they couldn't plot. And when the earthquake, and then they thought they were going to build up to the sky, they didn't bother God, and said God was all shook, and because they were going to build all the way to the sky, he said, whatsoever man does, there, nothing can stop him, and so forth. Well, it's not exactly that way. God wasn't a bit shaken. They had all the stuff in the world piled out in one straight rod. It wouldn't have got far enough to hurt anything. But the thing was that he had plans in the earth, and he had a program he was going to carry out. He wasn't going to let a bunch of people all messed up by a bunch of false priests upset this, so he gave him a big earthquake. And things started to fall, and someone started sliding down, and rocks started to fall, and everybody got scared, and everybody cried out in his own mother's tongue. And the moment he did that, he knew that somebody had heard, he could report him, and would get a prize, plus he'd lose his life, and they all took out for home. And it says everybody went, then it says people were divided according to their tongues, and by their tongues into their lands and back into their nations. Races didn't start down at Babel. That's where Babel is where they started to talk again, in their own language. Another question? I would think it would be tonight. Where do you want to go? You mean the Gospel Levi?
Well, levitation
of
Levi.
No. Only to this extent that the word levitation is falsely in our language. It isn't called that. It's got another name, phonomia, in some languages. And it belongs to pharmacopoeia in witchcraft. By the way, I think it's rather interesting. There's no doctors around here. I'm happy. But the Greek word for witchcraft and demon potions is pharmacopoeia. And the place where it's made is pharmacy. And the one who deals in sorcery, witchcraft, and potions is a pharmacist. Now, now this is not anything to do with our modern pharmacists, except that it deals with drugs and potions, and I'll show you where the scripture warned against it. But this is the word in Greek. This is Greek word for witchcraft and sorcery, and this is the word that original makers of potions and all kinds of herb groups, all these things, gave themselves. So they named themselves with the Greek word for witchcraft and so forth. Now, and there are areas of drugs and roots that come under the numbers of the pharmacopoeia, see? And this is rather significant because it's the same thing. The word, there's another word, fuma and pneumatic, see? We think of pneumatic as air, and pneumatic rifles and air guns and so forth. But pneumatic comes from unseen or spirit powers of, and so therefore if it's an unseen force, it was pneumatic, see? And so air compressed, you can't see it, so they call them pneumatic force, pneumatic compression. Anything compressed air was pneumatic, see? So this is semantics. Remember, there's Italian in all semantics. Especially does this get interesting when you get into religious and spiritual documents, because of the interlacing of semantics. Because if you dare to investigate anything that hasn't been accepted by some chain of orthodoxy, they're way out, see? But the scripture says something about someone being way out anyhow. The thing is that it's important to know the truth and not to be tied or laced down till you can't know the truth. The truth will set you free. The great invisible church of God and the retention of his church as a physical body is one of the basic factors that will continue, like nations will continue. And the design of Satan is to destroy church, nations, and thrones. The program of God is to hold together church, nations, and thrones. So, this we tell you, because this is significant. Now, within this area of to risk, to move, or to travel, in which it was done by areas of supposedly a spiritual cogitation, actually a form of witchcraft, was called levitation. Now, whether this had any connection with Levi or not, the sons of Levi, of course, being God's ordained spiritual masters, but they didn't move by the principles of levitation as are referred to today by the occultists, who get out of their bodies and roam around. Sometimes they die at it, too. Now, this is something that some people don't know about. There are areas that are called demonology, in which people leave their bodies and travel and come back in it. God told people not to do this, because if they do, some of them are never going to get back in. This happens, too, And this is, that's why we have disembodied spirits of different types that are obsessing forces. And this comes out of an area of Satanism that I don't want to get into tonight because it takes too much discussion. And when we get into areas which are not, shall we say, standardized sciences, whether they're occult or whether they're positive, well, it maybe takes a little more, maybe we need a little more advancement first. Other questions? Well, that's true. What I'm talking about is that there are areas of it that should not be discussed because people have such a lot of curiosity. And you know, people like to try things just once. So, I mean, there's up to a point. And sometimes you don't go up the point because you don't know the next step, yes, but you don't want to talk about the next step. Not in this, you see. There's a lot of things about to happen. The world's going to see the most terrible things that have ever happened in all history just about to take place. And we're going to survive through it, and we're going to come through it.